Welcome to Chapter 23, Subjecting the Subjunctives. In this chapter, we move away from the indicative forms that we've looked at so far, with the present, imperfect, future, aorist, perfect, and pluperfect, to the subjunctives. This is a different mood. Whereas the indicative was a mood of the statement of what normally happens, the subjunctive deals with possibilities and probabilities and mays and mights and possibles. The good thing about the subjunctive is the forms are relatively easy to learn, and you only have to deal with the present and aorist, so it's not too difficult to master the morphology and the forms. The problem with the subjunctive is the usages, the various usages that the subjunctive will have. But being the brightest and best, you'll have no problem with it. I'd like to begin with the Lord's Prayer, finishing it today, and then work on subjecting the subjunctives. Say the first part of the Lord's Prayer with me. Pater heimon ha en tois urenois hagias theto ta anamasu. Altheto he basileia su genetheto ta thalema su. And now the second part. Hos en ureno kai epiges. Tan ar tan heimon tan epiusian das heimin seimaran. And now the third section. Kai afis heimin ta afe lema ta heimon. Hos kai heimesa feka mentoisa feletais heimon. Now here's the new section. We'll go over it line by line. Kai me eisen en kes heimas. And this is, and may, do not, eisen en kes is to lead, heimas, us, eis perasman, into temptation, or some like to have a trial, so it doesn't conflict with the statement in James. And then the third line is, ala rusai heimas apa tu paneru. So ala is but, rusai is deliver, heimas, us, apa from tu paneru, the evil one. And then we add a little hey on the end to finish the beat of this. So let's put it all together now. Just listen to it the first time and then repeat it with me the second and third time. Kai me eisen nen kes heimas eis peiras man ala rusai heimas apa tu pane ru. Hey. And say it with me. Kai me eisen nen kes heimas eis peiras man ala rusai heimas apa tu pane ru. Hey. And one final time. Kai me eisen nen kes heimas eis peiras man ala rusai heimas apa tu pane ru. Hey. And that completes the Lord's Prayer. Let's just introduce and discuss the verbal moods and their relationships to one another. In Greek, we have basically four moods. We've got the indicative mood that we've already looked at. In this lesson, we'll be working on the subjunctive and the optative mood, and then in the next lesson, we'll be finishing off the imperative. The indicative mood was stereotyped as a mood of statement of fact, and you realize that it's not really a statement of fact so much as the author's perceived or the speaker's perceived portrayal of things as the way they are. Liars use the indicative mood, so it doesn't always mean that it's factual. Someone may believe that something's, you know, that's what happened, but it's not really what happened. But they'll use the indicative mood to portray basic historical narrative facts, and the indicative is our base mood that portrays just regular happenings. So, for example, Zach shoots the ball. Zach will shoot the ball. Zach has shot the ball. Just basically telling what happened. Wallace has got a great chart here. It's got about 15,600 something indicative moods. Whereas when we jump into the subjunctives, there'll only be about 1,850. So almost like one-tenth as many. And then the imperatives will be down to about 1,600, and the optatives only about 68. So we're not going to push the optatives. There's only about 68 of those, and there's stereotype forms that are used that even reduces that number. Once you get down meganoito and one or two other ones, you've pretty much got the optative down. The optative was kind of shifting out of use during the Hellenistic period. Classical period, it was used much more frequently, but the subjunctive is taking over a lot of the roles of the optative in Hellenistic Greek around the time of Christ. So, the subjunctive mood is a mood of possibility. The key words that we'll use for translating it are may and might. So, Zach may shoot the ball. It's a possibility. We don't know whether he has or whether he hasn't. It's possible. He may or might. And that's how we'll translate the subjunctive generally. But there'll be other uses as well. And you're used to the usage because we've seen so many usages with the participle and in the infinitive. The imperative mood, about 1,600 of those, is the mood of command or expectation. So, for example, we would have Zach shoot the ball as a kind of command and expectation. Go for it. Do it. And then lastly, the optative, and there's only 67, 68 of these in the whole New Testament, and this is a hope for or possibility, more remote possibility than the subjunctive. And so it will be translated things like, oh, that Zach would shoot the ball. A more remote possibility than the subjunctive. But again, the optative's not a big deal in the New Testament, but we just have to be aware of a few forms. So, four moods, the indicative mood, which we're already the master of, subjunctive mood, the imperative mood, and the optative. In this chapter, we knock out the subjunctive and the optative. Just a little introduction to the subjunctives in terms of tense. We only have to deal with the present and aorist in the subjunctive, and that's pretty nice. But you've got to be careful about oida. Do you remember oida? The perfect form was perfect, but it's translated active. It will appear sometimes in the subjunctive, but it's rare. So just be aware of that. But largely, we're focusing on the present and the aorist subjunctives. As in all the moods, tense connection with time's got to be broken here. It's more aspect than tense. It's not dealing with time in terms of the subjunctive. And so some call it the continuous subjunctive, the present, and the undefined subjunctive, the aorist. Simply the undefined aorist base background tense will be used for the subjunctive, and the continuous, the more durative action sart kind of thing, immediacy, and those types of ideas of aspect will be with the present. So just that distinction between the present and aorist, the aorist being a background tense and the present being a foregrounding tense. And then lastly, the time of the subjunctive will be dependent on the main verb or the context, and the context will indicate time oftentimes by adverbial little particles and conjunctions and prepositions that will tip you off to the temporal situation. But the temporal situation should not be derived from the form of the subjunctive, but rather from the context, and the context will shape and determine how the subjunctive makes its connection with time. No big deal, but we're used to this by now, but just be reminded, it's an aspectual thing, continuous action versus the undefined action of the aorist. Here's how the subjunctive is actually formed. It will use the primary endings, and those are our favorite endings. The active being o, as, a, amen, et, usi. We've already seen those, and we started out with those, so those are our good friends. Then the middle passive endings will be the my, a, etai, amatha, es, the anti endings. And again, those are our friends. We've seen them so many times. We love the primary endings. They will be used again on the subjunctive here. There will be, however, one little trick. The connecting vowel, which usually is an omicron or epsilon, will be lengthened to an omega and an eta. And so the present will be formed from lu, the root stem, plus this connecting vowel, which will go up from an omicron to an omega, and then you'll have your men first person plural ending. So it'll be luomen, meaning we may continue to loose. Again, we probably won't translate it so crassly, we may continue to loose. That gets a little long and a little pedantic, actually. But that's the idea with the present tense and this continuous aspect thing. We'll work with it that way initially here, but as we get into real translation, we'll probably drop the continue to. The aorist, interestingly enough, uses the sigma. And we remember our sa, sa, everywhere, sa, sa for the first aorist. So it's lu, again, no augment on the front. The augments are only used in the indicative. So it's lu and then a sigma. And then the omicron goes up to an omega. And then you've got your men forms. So it's lusomen. We may loose. You say, take a good look at that form, lusomen. You say, boy, that looks an awful lot like the future. There's no augment to tell you that it's the aorist. And there is this kind of background connection between the future and the subjunctive. The forms are somewhat similar, and the meanings are also similar. The future could be said to be a tense of the possibility. Whereas possibility, expectation, it hasn't happened yet. And so there's some semantic overlap between and kind of play that goes on between the subjunctive and the future. Just keep that in the back of your mind, but it's not a big deal. Here's the paradigm for the present or continuous active subjunctive. You'll notice it sounds very familiar. Luo, luace, lue. You notice we've gone from that epsilon iota to the eta long form. You'll notice that luo is the same exact form as the indicative. So the context is going to have to tell you, and there'll be certain trigger words that'll tell you this is subjunctive. For the plural, we have luomen, luete, and luocene. So again, those are differentiated by the omega and eta, so those aren't as difficult to distinguish. But the first person singular, got to be careful with that one. They'll be translated, I may loose, you may loose, he, she, it may loose. And again, the continue thing we may drop out, but to just understand that that's talking a more durative type of thing with the present aspect. Now, the present or continuous middle passive subjunctives are formed using the primary endings as well. So we have luomai, lue, luetai. And you'll notice the lue looks very familiar. And so some of these forms we're going to have to depend on the context to distinguish. The plural forms, luometha, lueistha, luontai. Again, the endings sound familiar. Just that connecting vowel shifts up to an omega and up to an eta away from the omicron and epsilon. Now the passives will be translated, I may be loosed, you may be loosed, he, she, it may be loosed. And that's a passive way of translating it. For the middle, we may end up translating them just straight up active, emphasizing the participation of the subject in the action of the verb. I may continue loosing. You may continue loosing. Or it may go beneficial, so it may be I may continue loosing for myself. You may continue loosing for yourself, etc. Couple ways to take the middle there. And the middle passive forms, of course, in the present are exactly the same. But the context will help separate them in terms of which one should be used. And as we know by now, the mantra, context determines meaning. The aorist or undefined active subjunctives take the primary endings as well. And as we're used to in the aorist, seeing the sigma in there, this is actually a fairly, we know all the forms, it's just the way of putting it together. You'll notice again, there's no augment here augment only in the indicative. The subjunctive does not take it. So it leaves our first form, luso, looks exactly the same as our future. Again, the connection between the subjunctive and future, keep that in the back of your mind. So our forms are luso, luces, luce, lusomen, lucete, lusosin. And they will be translated, I may loose, you may loose, he, she, it may loose, we may loose, etc. So the forms are fairly easy. They both, the present and the aorist, take the primary endings, which we have grown so accustomed to, the OASA. The only thing you got to remember is that the OASA uses the connecting vowel, the omega and eta, rather than the normal omicron epsilon. It's nice to have some easy forms after the participles and the infinitives, right? The aorist, or undefined middle subjunctives, take again the primary endings, so it's lusomai, luce, lucetai. And the plural forms? Lusometha, luceste, lusontai. And these middles will be translated either active, emphasizing the participation of the subject in the action of the verb, basically translated, I may loose, you may loose, he, she, it may loose, or in a beneficial manner, I may loose for myself, you may loose for yourself, he, she, it may loose for himself, herself, or itself. So these forms, again, fairly easily indicated that it's aorist by the sigma and that it's middle because of the endings being the middle passive endings. Now, the aorist or undefined passive subjunctives take the theta, which triggers that it's passive, again, no augment on the front, but they take, interestingly, the active, primary active endings. So they're kind of nice that way. So it's lutho, luthes, luthe, luthomen, luthete, luthosi. And it's simply translated, I may be loosed, you may be loosed, he, she, it may be loosed, we may be loosed, using the may or might possibility type of thing. So the aorist passives, very easily recognized. Just got to remember it's the OASA endings, and you've got it. Now, of course, when we're dealing with the aorist, we've got the first aorist triggered by the sigma. Then, of course, you know to expect by now, we've got a second aorist active in the form of lapo, I leave. And so here's the paradigm for second aorist. You'll notice there's no sigma. There's the shifting of the root. And they use the primary endings of the active primary endings that we're so used to. So this is actually no problem. You just got to remember to switch the root and then add the primary active endings on, shifting to the eta and omega. So the forms are lipo, lipes, lipe, lipomen, lipete, liposine. And it means I may leave, you may leave, he, she, it may leave, we may leave, exactly the same as the other, the aorist, except that it's formed differently because it's formed from a second aorist root rather than using the sigma of the first aorist. Piece of cake. Hardest part with the second aorist, however, is remembering those bad boy roots. Now, back to one of our old favorites, the subjunctivizing of a me. And this actually, you're going to see this form. It's used fairly frequently. It'll also be used with the paraphrastics. You remember when you shifted the mood in the paraphrastics, you used the a me verb plus the participle for a paraphrastic? These will be the forms that will be used for the subjunctive of that paraphrastic form and just regular a me in the subjunctive. What's really nice is that these are just flat out the endings, and so it's not really a big deal. It's easy to learn, but you just got to be aware when you see these barren forms that it's a me in disguise again. So it's o ace a, and then the plural forms omen ate osin. And it's I may be, you may be, he, she, it may be, we may be, etc. is how it's translated. You'll see these around, so just be aware. Sometimes these forms, by the way, the ace and things and the A and the O, will look like relative pronouns. So you got to be aware of these forms, subjunctive. These are not the relative pronouns. The relative pronouns take the rough breathing. These will take the smooth breathing, and the forms are long and stuff. So just be aware that these will look like some other things. Just be aware that this is the subjunctive of a me. Now, there are four subjunctive triggers, as I call them here. Whenever you see these little particles, these little words, start looking around for a subjunctive. If the forms are similar, as we noticed with the future and with a me, with some of the other forms and stuff, be aware whenever you see one of these triggers that you need to start looking for a subjunctive to follow it. The major one is or hina. It's in order that, and then it will take a subjunctive. And this is very frequent, the hina plus the subjunctive. Whenever you see hina, look for a subjunctive. They go together, and this is used very frequently. Another word that triggers a subjunctive is e'an. And it means if or when, and then it has followed by a subjunctive. If you're working with an if in the indicative, it'll be an a form, epsilon iota. But when you're in the subjunctive, the if form becomes a'an. So just be aware of that. When you see a'an, know to start looking for a subjunctive to follow it. Less frequent is this has'an, and it's whoever plus the subjunctive. So do you notice the an there occurring? Actually an e'an and then hasan here. So this an is kind of has that subjunctive flavor to it. He'os is used also with the subjunctive. So it's until and then plus the subjunctive. So these are four trigger words for the subjunctive, but especially keep note of hina and e'an. And basically on itself, those will tell you that there's a subjunctive coming. And if you know to expect it, it's easy to recognize, wherever it may or may not appear. As we had four triggers, there are also four functions of the subjunctive we want to look at. The first is called the hortatory subjunctive. This is translated like let us or let me. It's a hortatory. It requires the first person, so it'll either be the first person singular, me, or the first person plural, we. And it'll be translated, let us go, or let us pray, or let me take you, that kind of thing. A hortatory nature to it. A second function of the subjunctive is in a purpose clause, and hina is often used to trigger this. In order that he might run. And so it's telling the purpose of something. And you can remember purpose and result, sometimes hard to distinguish. And that'll come up here as well. So the subjunctive purpose clause comes up. And then thirdly, the prohibitive subjunctive. And this will be in things like where there's a prohibition, and they'll use the subjunctive as a prohibition. The imperative will be used a lot for this too, but the subjunctive as well. Lead us not into temptation or trials. The lead us not is don't lead us there. That's a prohibition. You know this as kai me asa nen kes hemas, ace peras man. Do not me asa nen kes. Lead us, that's your subjunctive. Second person, you do not lead us, hemas. Ace peras man, into temptation. So the hortatory, the purpose clause, and the prohibition need to be added to our normal may and might as far as possibilities with the subjunctive. The final function of the subjunctive is this deliberative subjunctive, and this is often used as a kind of a rhetorical device and in rhetorical questions. What's the difference between a regular question and a rhetorical question? A rhetorical question does not really expect an answer. A rhetorical question is actually a statement in the dress of a question, but actually can be used for all sorts of other purposes. It's not calling forth an answer. What is it calling forth? Sometimes the rhetorical questions are used for rebuke, and sometimes they're used to emphasize a point. and a teacher will ask a question. It's a rhetorical question sometimes. What does it mean? He's not really asking you what it means. He's wanting to focus your attention on something. It's always fun when a student raises their hands and tries to answer a rhetorical question. So, for example, what shall I say to you? He says. Now, is that really asking them what the content of what he should say to them? No. It's actually, you can tell by the way it's said, it's a rebuke. He's saying, what can I do for you? And so there'll be pragmatic ways and functions that these rhetorical questions will do while not asking for the content to be supplied. So the deliberative subjunctive is fun. There's a topic that I want to introduce now. It's called the four types of conditional sentences in Greek. And this is, we'll introduce it here, second year Greek. You can actually flesh out the nuances of these various things. But I'll just introduce it here so you're aware of the concepts and develop it and flesh it out later on. What is a conditional statement? A conditional statement is an if-then statement. So you have, if I go to the store, then I will pick up some milk. It's an if-then. If A, then B. If X, then Y. And in Greek, it triggers different ways that this prothesis, as it's called, the ifs part, relates to the apodosis, the then part of the sentence. And these will be triggered by the structure, syntactical structure of the Greek. What's called a first-class condition works off an assumed reality, or it's assumed true for the sake of argument. It actually may not be actually true, but it's assumed true for the sake of argument. So, for example, if you come, then I will take you down to Boston. And how is this built? It's built basically with A, if, plus the indicative verb. And that's what indicates basically you've got a first-class condition. Assumed true for the sake of argument. Now, the second class condition is called a contrary to fact. And this is something like this. If you had come, he would not have died. But you didn't come. So it's contrary to fact. How do you build this contrary to fact? It's A plus the aorist or imperfect indicative, plus on and the aorist or imperfect indicative. And so it's if indicative, then on the indicative. And that's a contrary to fact structure when something didn't happen that maybe should have. If you had come, he would not have died. But he did die because you didn't come. Actually, as far as frequency, the first class condition is used about 300 times. There's about 600 conditionals in the New Testament. 300 of them are first class, and almost 300 of them are third class, with a few of these contrary to fact. So it's not as frequent as the other ones. Now, the third class condition is frequent, almost 300 times with this one, as well as the first class condition. And it's the class of probability. If you come, then you are my friend. But you have not yet come, so I don't know whether I can assume this as being true or not. I can't assume it for the sake of argument because it's still a possibility. And this uses aon plus the subjunctive. And so as we would expect, the subjunctive has this notion of probability, possibility, expectation, intention, that type of thing. And it's as in contrast to the indicative. There is, however, some overlap between the first-class condition and third-class condition. Sometimes they can be used to reference almost the same ideas. So be careful about separating them too much, but then on the other hand, don't collapse them all into one. The third-class condition has more the notion of possibility and probability. So those are the first three of our first-class, second-class, and third-class condition. First-class, A plus the indicative. Second-class, A plus the aorist or imperfect indicative, plus on and the aorist or imperfect indicative. and third class condition, e'an, plus the subjunctive. These three are the ones that are largely used. Now, there's a thing called the fourth class condition, and we'll catch that next. But it's very infrequent. And our fourth class conditional is a condition of possibility. And so it's a, epsilon iota, plus the optative. And you said, wow, I thought you said the optative was like used like 68 times or less than 70 times. So obviously this fourth type of conditional doesn't really occur totally in the New Testament. Actually, a lot of times you just get fragments of it where you'll have the protasis of the conditional, and that's all. So this is very rare, but you should be aware of it, a plus the optative. And it's like, if you should suffer, etc., then, you know, whatever. If you should suffer, it's a possibility. Not saying it's probable, but it's a more remote possibility using the optative, which is pretty rare. Now, speaking of the optative, let's go to the next slide and figure out how the optatives are actually formed. Now, the optative is the mood of wish, and it occurs about 68 times in the New Testament, as compared to the 1,800 times that the subjunctive is used. So it's rather infrequent. It's characterized by an internal addition of an oi, I, or a diphthong as the internal connector between the root and the ending. So instead of the omicron epsilon going long as in the subjunctive, the connecting vowel here goes to a diphthong, an oi, I, or a diphthong. An example, probably the most famous and repeated optative, is genoita. And this is used, may genoita, may it never be. It's a wish, mood of wish, and it's an aorist form from genomai. And so, may it be, genoita. And it usually comes with a may in front of it. May it never be. And Apostle Paul will use that as a wish. May it never be. So that may genoita, just learn that form and you've got a lot of the optatives down just right there. Dunaimane is also another one. You see how it uses the alpha iota diphthong there to connect the ending onto this dunamai. And it's a present deponent or present middle passive first person singular. Oh, that I would be able to, from dunamai, that I would be able to. It's a wish. Oh, that I would be able to. An interesting form that occurs quite frequently in these optatives is AA. And as you would expect, this is a me, third person singular, present tense, optative of a me. Means, oh, that he, she, it might be. And so these are just some examples of the optative. When you see it and you've got that oi, I, a in the middle there, start thinking optative, but realize they're pretty rare. As we said, the subjunctive was largely taking over the role of the optatives in Hellenistic Greek, Koine Greek. And so the optative was kind of dying out, and that's why there's only 68 of them in the New Testament. But may genoita, may you never miss one of these optatives when you spot it. Now, in Greek, there are two ways of doing these negative rhetorical questions. Don't you just love these rhetorical questions? The first way is with ou. And ou implies, when you use the ou, it implies a yes answer to the rhetorical question. So, for example, Elliot, you are going to study tonight, aren't you? Yes, of course, Mother. If you believe that, I've got a bridge I'd like to sell you. If you wanted a negative answer, you would use the word may. May implies nay. May implies a no answer to the rhetorical question. You are not going to study tonight, are you? No, most likely not. And so the ou is like oui in French, means yes. Ou, it goes to yes, and may goes to no in terms of rhetorical questions when they're stated in the negative. So it's kind of handy to know, ooh, yes, may, nay. You will study Greek, won't you? I wonder whether he used ooh or may. Here's a couple translations to illustrate the subjunctive. Kai hati u crayon aken hina tis marturese peri tu anthropu. And it's translated, and because hati, he did not have need, aken, have, crayon, need, that, hina, and soon as you see the hina, you say, whoops, we've got a subjunctive coming, tis, anyone, might witness, and there's your subjunctive. It's the aorist subjunctive of martureo. And you see how the ada goes long there, and the connecting vowel also is long in the martirese. You see the sigma, and you say, that's an aorist. There's no augment, but that's okay. It's a subjunctive, so it doesn't take the augment. And then peri tu anthropu, concerning humankind. So just an example of a regular subjunctive, hina plus the subjunctive, very common. Our second example is hina pas ha pistuon en auto eke zoein ionian. And this is translated again, hina tells you there's a subjunctive coming. Hina, that anyone, pas, believing, or everyone believing, in him, might have, eke, might have. We didn't say might continue to have, we just said might have, it's present tense though, might have eternal life, zoein ionian. Emphasizing the durative nature of that, using and foregrounding that idea, using the present subjunctive. Here's the vocabulary for chapter 23. The first word is ago, and it means I lead or bring. The second word is apaluo, and it means I set free. The third word is eta, and it means if or whether. The fourth word is entale, and it means commandment. The fifth word is karpas, and it means fruit. The sixth word is pistas aon, and it means faithful. The seventh word is presbuteros aan, and it means elder. The eighth word is rhema, and it means word. The ninth word is sabbaton, and it means Sabbath. And the tenth word is pharaoh, and it means I bear.